You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. New York Magazine writer Mark Harris, my guest today, says that his latest biographical subject is that rare person that transformed three major entertainment genres, comedy, theater, and film, and he did it all by the age of 35. Mike Nichols seemingly came out of nowhere. Born Igor Peshkovsky, he left Nazi Germany at the age of 8, right before World War II. By the age of 30, he'd already transformed comedy, thanks to his work with partner Elaine May. Their semi-improvised comedic sketches were a staple on television and the subject of a hit Broadway show. The theater was next. His innovative staging and direction transformed two Neil Simon comedies, Barefoot in the Park and The Odd Couple, and his first four plays on Broadway were all hits. Next came film. His first film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, with its explicit language, helped break down the restrictive production codes that had governed films since the 1930s. His next film, The Graduate, transformed film itself and won him an Oscar. Over the next 40 years, Nichols would become a fixture, directing both in film and theater. While not all of his 60-plus productions were hits or critically acclaimed, Nichols consistently made interesting, compelling work at his best, bringing the best out in his actors. He was an actor's director, something Harris witnessed firsthand when Nichols directed the film adaptation of his husband Tony Kushner's groundbreaking play, Angels in America. Nichols' story is recounted in Mark Harris's new book, Mike Nichols, A Life. Mark Harris is the author of two previous books, Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, which also featured The Graduate, and Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Mark Harris, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This book about Mike Nichols is so interesting. And Mike Nichols is one of those rare artists that come around, I think, every generation or so that changed their art forms in such a profound way that within just a few years of those changes taking place, they're taken for granted in both theater and film. What attracted you to writing about him?
Well, it's true. I mean, he was this extraordinary innovator, really on three fronts, because, you know, he had these extraordinary careers for 50 years as both a theater director and a film director, and absolutely did change both mediums, with particularly with his early work. And before that, he had a career as a performer, as a comedy performer, and changed comedy. So I thought, you know, any one of those three careers would be worthy of a book, but that the same man had all three of them, it just felt like that would give me an infinite amount to explore. And there were also so many questions about Mike that I didn't know the answers to, and that for me is a great way to go into a book, just with a long, long list of questions you want to answer.
Now, Mike Nichols was somebody you knew for about the last 15 years of his life. What was it that you didn't know about him?
Well, when I met Mike Nichols, he was probably close to 70. It was when he was about to start directing the film version of Angels in America, which my husband had written. And so when I encountered him, he was obviously very well established and at a very happy, hard-won place of contentment in his life. So I think one thing that surprised me was that the road to that had been really rough. And I mean, I knew that he had, like anybody, made certain films in his career that were successes, certain films that were failures, but I felt that he had a pretty unblemished record. I didn't realize that he had wrestled so much with depression, that his childhood had been so difficult, that there had been so many challenges to face. And just creatively, I didn't know very much about what turned him into the director that he became and what turned him into a director in the first place. So all of that was really interesting for me to learn.
Having known him for the last 15 years or so of his life, how did you find that detachment to write about him honestly? Was there any special things you had to do to sort of say, you know, yes, I know him, I like him, I find him immensely interesting every time I speak with him? Did you have to form a sort of detachment to really write about him? Because you write about his foibles, and, you know, he had considerable foibles.
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I certainly did worry about that question that you're asking, like whether I would be able to detach enough, which I knew that I absolutely needed to do, to write the book. I honestly worried about it more during the research period, which was about 3.5 years, than during the writing, because by the time it came for me to write the book, I felt I had already done that. And I think what made it possible for me, you know, whether sitting in the library and or talking to other people, because there was a lot of library research and I also did about 250 interviews, was the Mike Nichols I met was not recognizable to me in the times when I was talking to people about who he was in 1955 or 1963 or when I was reading accounts of those times and his work during those years and his behavior during those years. You know, none of us are entirely the same person that we were, you know, 30 years or 40 years earlier. And although there were times when I felt Mike Nichols sort of looking over my shoulder as I was reading about him, and although not a day went by when I didn't think of a new set of questions I wished I could ask him, mostly I was able to detach for really long periods of time and just forget that I was writing about someone that I had ever known. And the only thing that would snap me back into remembering it was hearing a recording of his voice. That was a surprisingly difficult thing, that suddenly I would hear audio of him and that would make me remember the Mike that I knew. But while I was doing research or interviewing people, I really was able to detach. And that was the only way to write this book. It would have really been impossible if I had been worried about what Mike would think or about protecting him, you know, or protecting his reputation. That just would have made it not worth writing the book.
His early story is compelling and one that he took some care really never to publicize. He came over on one of the last boats to leave Germany for America. His father, who was a doctor here, died young, sort of propelling their family into a precarious position. And that sort of shows up in his early life. You know, he's a brilliant person, but he's also insecure that he sort of covers up by being brilliant. And again, there's this sort of work towards being secure and also some of the just sort of things that go along with theater and film in which, you know, nobody says no to you, and so he does what he wants.
Right. I mean, I think Mike's childhood and the rough circumstances of it are really important in understanding who he became. I mean, this was not by any stretch an easy start. As you said, you know, he was an immigrant. He came to America at 7, not speaking English. He lost his father pretty young. His relationship with his mother was quite stormy. He had no hair. That, you know, I think we have to think about a world in which, you know, a 7-year-old bald refugee boy is going to be treated even more cruelly, you know, than some kids might treat him now. I mean, bullying was just an absolute fact of life, and I think the attitude was, well, you just have to be tough and put up with it. So out of all of that, you know, came an intense desire to prove himself, and an intense need, just as a survival strategy, to create a kind of viable external self that would allow him to get through every day as a little kid or as an adolescent or as a young man. And yes, with that, an intense desire to be on the inside of something instead of on the outside looking in. And, you know, I don't think you can understand the trajectory of Mike's early career, starting with his partnership with Elaine May in Chicago when they were both just 20 or 21 years old, without understanding how much pain preceded it.
his role to the theater just seemed to be somewhat haphazard. He comes to the theater, he meets Elaine May, they develop this partnership pretty early, and it just takes off.
Right. It was hard for me to understand initially as I was working on the book that when they talked about Nichols and May's success being so fast, like, how did that happen? And I really had to remind myself that, in a way, television was much more of a mass medium back then than it was now. It was, there were only really three networks. So if you made a successful appearance on a variety show or a talk show, you could really start to become famous overnight, which is what happened with them. And they had this remarkable ascent from, you know, playing small clubs and bars in Chicago to coming to New York and performing in nightclubs and getting some good critical notice here, to getting to do a sketch or two on things like the Steve Allen Show or the Dinah Shore Show, to putting out comedy albums, and then finally to their own Broadway show, which was just this immense success that ran for 8 or 9 months on Broadway and attracted, you know, so much attention, including from celebrities. I mean, every famous person not just in New York, but in Los Angeles and in London wanted to see Mike Nichols and Elaine May and wanted to know them. So it kind of opened every door all at once.
And what's interesting in the book is, you know, we think of it happening immediately, but what you write is that Mike didn't take to improvisation effortlessly like Elaine May seemed to. He had to really work hard, and they actually worked quite hard on getting that sort of effortless rapport.
Oh, yeah, they both. I mean, they really learned so much through trial and error, and definitely there were errors about what works in front of an audience, what doesn't work in front of an audience, why it's better to get a laugh naturally than to chase it, how it's important for an audience to be able to see something recognizable from their own lives and your behavior. I mean, those were all the foundations of the development of their comedy. And they really did turn out to be a perfect team, because Mike often said that Elaine was the inventive one, that if you came up with characters and a premise, she could fill it endlessly with new material and new sort of funny ways for it to go. But that Mike became more of an expert in giving a scene shape and understanding when it was time to move from one beat of it to the next, and then finally understanding when it was time for it to end before it overstayed its welcome, which in a way means that he was learning a couple of the fundamentals of directing, even as a performer.
My guest today is Mark Harris, a writer at New York Magazine and author of two previous books on film history. His latest book is a biography of Mike Nichols. It tracks his career in performing with Elaine May, in comedy, in theater, and in film. And it's a really interesting book about his process. And there was a one piece that came about with Elaine May that sort of has some echoes in his early film career. And that is the one piece they never filmed or never performed. That was called Pirandello. And it was about a couple that gets into a vicious argument to the point of where it would almost approach violence. And then the denouement would be, it's Pirandello. And I think that comes into good stead when he makes his first film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I think that's right. I mean, Pirandello was, which does not exist anywhere, by the way. It was the only major sketch of theirs that they never recorded even audio for. But it was this really interesting game in which they were playing with the expectations and understanding of their audience. You know, they were playing with the question of, like, well, are we seeing a sketch in which two people are fighting, or are these two performers actually beginning to irritate each other on stage? And like, are we seeing the sort of breakdown of a partnership in process in front of our eyes? And people have said that on the best nights of Pirandello, it was just profoundly uncomfortable because you really didn't know that you were being fooled until the very end, and that Nichols and May would really commit to it. And what is Mike's first movie, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but a movie about a couple invested in playing a game that strays into really dangerous territory when they either don't remember what the parameters of the game are or stop agreeing on them. In a way, all of the work that Mike had done with Elaine was a perfect prep for him directing that movie. And you know, he never lost his interest in Virginia Woolf years after he made the movie and years after his performing partnership with Elaine May had ended. He and Elaine decided to play the parts played by Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in a stage revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So it was that play was very much in his DNA for decades.
Yeah. And of course, he's making that film with no less than Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. And that's his first film. But of course, he had the same sort of experience on Broadway when he first came to Broadway, doing two plays that are perhaps some of the most performed plays ever. Barefoot in the Park with Neil Simon. And he helped make that play what it has become. And he did it in a way which I think the staging that was a part of that play, as you write, is now taken for granted that that's how you do a play. And nobody had done it like that before, where you're not talking to each other. You're unpacking boxes. You're looking at the other way in a room. It was a very naturalistic staging that transformed theater.
Right. I think if you just read the play Barefoot in the Park, you wouldn't necessarily know from it what was so extraordinary about what Mike Nichols did with it and with Neil Simon and with his two stars, Robert Redford and Elizabeth Ashley. Because it reads like a lot of bright Broadway comedies of the early 60s. The dialogue is very snappy. It's a little bit sitcomish. It's very kind of moving from one joke to the next, the way a lot of Neil Simon's work was. But to hear people talk about it who saw Barefoot in the Park on Broadway, they felt almost that, you know, they had gone into this play expecting to see sort of a bright, fun comedy about a young married couple in their apartment in the first week of their married life. And it almost at times felt to them when they were watching it like they were spying on somebody, because here they were watching people in the privacy of their own apartment behaving in ways, doing the little odd things that couples do and that you do when you're alone in an apartment that they hadn't seen on stage before. And that was one of Mike's great gifts. He wanted to make whatever people were watching, if not strictly realistic, recognizable, so that they could, even in the most outrageous situation, have a moment where they could say, oh, yes, I've done that. Or, oh, how embarrassing, I thought I was the only person who ever did that when I was alone, but I'm not. And that really was his unique gift as a stage director.
Of course, he comes from the theater. We mentioned Virginia Woolf, and then the next film is The Graduate, which utterly changed film.
Right.
I mean, Woolf changed film to a degree, because all of a sudden it's doing themes that film really had shied away from because of the production codes. But The Graduate
right.
does change film utterly.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me always that The Graduate was supposed to be his first film, and then the opportunity to direct Virginia Woolf came along, and so The Graduate becomes his second film. But I think it, in a way, was always meant to be his second film, because he needed to learn what he learned on Virginia Woolf in order to make The Graduate what it was. But you can understand, in retrospect, why he thought The Graduate would be a good first film, because, you know, it wasn't going to cost a great deal of money. It was low profile. He cast someone in it who was not famous at the time in the leading role. And I don't think that anyone involved in The Graduate, certainly including Mike Nichols, realized that it might turn into this immense movie industry changing cultural phenomenon until the film was done. I mean, Mike certainly had a very strong vision for it and knew what he wanted to do with it, and kind of uncharacteristically kept his own counsel during a lot of the movie, and really did feel he was doing something very different than what had been done previously. But I don't think he necessarily knew that that difference was going to turn The Graduate into the third highest grossing film in history, which is what it became by the end of its run.
Yeah, and I was struck by something you wrote. You said, you know, the producers thought they were making a film for the parents of Benjamin Braddock, and the film was actually for the Benjamin Braddocks of the world, and that literally flipped filmmaking, which it has ever since. So I thought that was an interesting point. I want to move on, though. One of the things that really is interesting in this book is you talk about his process as a director with actors. At times, very haughty and dismissive, but other times, very caring. And it reminded me something that Howard Cosell said about Vince Lombardi. He treated every single player differently. He never yelled at one player, but he would scream at other players incessantly, and not to the same degree that Nichols worked with his actors. He was more, you know, had to be more caring to get people to sort of reveal their inner selves as they're acting. But it was that same sort of thing, that he treated every actor differently, even actors that he really couldn't get along with, like George C. Scott. He had this ability to work with all sorts of people and bring out great performances from them.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Nichols would put up with a lot from someone he thought was a great actor. I mean, George C. Scott was a very difficult guy. So was Walter Matthau, who starred as Oscar in the stage version of The Odd Couple, and who gave both Nichols and his co-star, Art Carney, no end of grief. Richard Burton was certainly not difficult with other actors, but was difficult with his own wife, and was also really struggling with alcoholism, to the point where there were days on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf where he couldn't work. I think the Vince Lombardi comparison is great, because Mike really did try to figure out what each actor needed, whether it was tenderness or toughness, whether it was to have things from their own past pulled out of them, or things from Mike's past shared with them. You know, he really he understood what frail creatures actors are, in a way, and also what hard work it is for them to find their way into performances. And he really he didn't view anything about getting a good performance out of an actor or helping an actor to a good performance as tedious. He loved that work. He found it fascinating. The only thing he really could not put up with in actors was laziness or cruelty. And if he saw either of those things, he really would get impatient or reach the end of his rope.
My guest today is Mark Harris. His new book is titled Mike Nichols, A Life, which looks at his directing career, his acting career early in his life as a comedian, and later he did a little bit of acting, and of course he produced pieces and directed films. And you know, he had a share of flops, both on Broadway and in film. There's a wonderful little scene during Catch 22, the filming. Orson Welles comes on the set, and everybody hated him, and Orson Welles was being a gigantic jerk, I guess would be the a discreet word. But there was this moment where Welles is holding forth, and he talked about, you know, hey, you either build slowly and come to a peak, or you peak early and then you decline. And, you know, Mike Nichols was going through that at that. He was just starting this sort of a small decline in his career. You know, he had a series of flops, and yet he came back with a film set in Oklahoma about an industrial worker, Karen Silkwood, and that seemed to reinvigorate him.
Right, it really did. Mike hit a bad streak in the mid-1970s where it's sort of like a pitcher who loses his pitch. He suddenly wasn't finding the sweet spot anymore. And he stopped making movies for 7 or 8 years. And when he came back, which was with Silkwood in the early 1980s, which was the first time he worked with Meryl Streep, his approach changed a little bit. I mean, his priorities changed in that his work became less about realizing his personal vision and more about just chasing his own passion and excitement. If the material in a script or the chance to work with a writer excited Mike Nichols, or if he was excited by the prospect of working with a particular actor, that was often enough for him to decide to jump in and do something. And I think that's, you know, at the heart of his collaborative spirit, and it's why you see such a wide range of types of movies that he made over the decades that he was directing, because he really wasn't looking to tell the same story on screen over and over again, or to have each movie be a kind of chapter in a completely thematically coherent filmography. He was going after what he loved for the most part, or what was right for him, and or what felt right for him at the moment, and that was different things at different times. Sometimes he really wanted a mountain to climb, sometimes he didn't. And so I think that's one of the reasons his filmography ends up being so diverse and eclectic and interesting.
Well, for those who would like to go back and sort of see some of the most important films, where do you recommend people go to get a sense of his filmmaking, since we can't go back to see the plays?
Well, often I don't think necessarily you should start at the beginning, but with Mike Nichols, you know, if your first two movies were Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate, which were his first two movies, you can really begin to get a sense of his range and a sense of his passions, a sense of his humor, and a hint of what lies ahead, although what lies ahead will surprise you. You know, he really didn't make the same movie twice. And, I mean, I think those are great entry points. And if you want something newer, his 80s output, Heartburn or Silkwood or Working Girl, I mean, there are a lot of interesting doors in, but why not start at the start?
And, you know, of course, the one film he did that involved Neil Simon was Biloxi Blues. And what's always interesting to me is casting Walken as the drill sergeant, which was utterly different than the Broadway casting. And, of course, he got that wonderful idiosyncratic performance out of him that was just strange and different and really enjoyable, even though, you know, it was a lovely comic film. And that's sort of a part of Mike Nichols as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Matthew Broderick, who starred in the play on Broadway and who stars in the movie, said that Nichols' decision to put Christopher Walken in the drill sergeant part and to have it be played by Walken in this almost kind of low-key, crazy way, not yelling at the top of his lungs, but being this kind of loose cannon who could go off any minute, Matthew Broderick said that changed his whole performance because he had to create a completely different dynamic than he had created on stage. And in doing so, that changed the whole play and the nature of the storytelling. So Nichols was so good at figuring out how to take something and freshen it and make it a challenge for everyone by just twisting or tweaking one element of it.
Mark Harris, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Harris is a writer for New York Magazine, and his latest book is titled Mike Nichols, A Life. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. And thanks for listening. I'm Rich Fisher.